Would you rather go to war in a tank that was quick but lightly armoured?
Or heavily armoured but slow?
Tank design is the challenge of finding the right balance between firepower, mobility and protection, or what's known as the Iron Triangle. But often speed and mobility are compromised for thicker, heavier armour.
Some tanks are designed to be fast, relying on speed and mobility to compensate for lack of armour.
The theory is that speed or mobility in itself can act as a form of protection against the enemy. But does that work?
Looking at some of the fastest tanks in history, we will look at why they were built, what they were for, how they were put together, and look at the times their speed and mobility gave them the edge.
And we'll look at when it didn't, because amongst them are arguably some of the worst tanks ever built.
This is the story of fast tanks. So what makes a tank fast? Because that's something that's easier said than done. Well, to be fast, a tank has got to have an excellent power-to-weight ratio. What that is the amount of power something generates relative to its weight. The power comes from the engine, like this Rolls-Royce Meteor. And that produces torque, which is the muscle power, and horsepower, which is the speed at which the muscle is used. As for weight, well, a tank is a hulking great lump of metal, so there's a fair bit to think about there.
To reduce the weight, you can look at making it smaller, but that causes its own problems. And you can try to have as many of the components as possible made out of lighter metals.
But you may also have to sacrifice some of the heavier bits, like armament, ammunition stowage, and most importantly, armour.
And the faster you can get anything heavy to move, the more important suspension becomes to absorb the impacts from crossing uneven terrain, allowing it to manoeuvre with more stability.
Obviously, in regards to tanks, the term fast is always going to be relative. There are no land speed records being set here by any means. So what do we mean when we actually say fast tank? Well, in World War II, the average medium tank, such as this M4A2E8 Sherman, or a German equivalent, a Panzer IV, could do about 25 miles an hour on the road, and about half that when going cross-country. So for this episode, we're going to be talking about tanks that were considerably faster than the average of the time.
A fast tank uses its speed and mobility to put itself into a position where it can surprise the enemy by exploiting gaps and carrying out flanking movements, just like the cavalry had been doing for centuries.
First tanks used on a battlefield, the British and French heavy tanks of the First World War, were slow. They just moved at walking pace.
But they didn't have to be fast. All they had to do was roll forward with the infantry, crush the barbed wire, and deal with the enemy machine guns.
And that's something they're pretty good at. But what they couldn't do, having broken the line, was to push further into enemy territory and inflict strategic damage.
This is where the cavalry should take over, exploiting the breach and disrupting the enemy response by carving up his support lines.
But this never really worked out. We've got a prime example from the Battle of Cambrai, November 1917. Mass tank attack smashes a hole in the German lines 4 miles wide. But the cavalry don't arrive in time to exploit the breach, and the gains are subsequently lost.
So already, a tank that could replace cavalry in mobile warfare was being considered. And that is where this machine comes in. The Medium Mark A Whippet, as the name suggests, was one of the first tanks to introduce speed and mobility onto the battlefield. It's not very fast, and it will do 8 miles an hour on a good day, but that's still 4 times faster than the Mark IV, and in 1918, the Whippet was seen as the future.
At Cashy in April 1918, 7 Whippets used their speed to outflank enemy artillery and their mobility to surprise and ambush 2 battalions of German infantry that were forming up for an attack.
They shot down, or ran over, around 400 infantry.
Battlefield success like this was what the fast tank of the future promised. And that's what the generals were eager to get a piece of.
A tank can have as much power and torque as it likes, but unless it can cope with the terrific forces moving fast across country, it will smash itself and its crew to bits. In the 1920s, one of the men who realised this and set about solving it was the American ex-racing driver J. Walter Christie. He understood that suspension was essential to delivering speed and mobility on the battlefield.
His solution was the helicoil spring system, powerful coiled springs connected to large road wheels with space for lots of vertical travel to absorb that impact when traveling across country at speed. Christie was a brilliant engineer and his system worked.
His M1931 prototype weighed 10 tonnes and was capable of 40 miles an hour on the road and 25 miles an hour across country, at least twice as fast as anything comparable.
It used a V12 Liberty engine, which was based on an aero engine, so it had a high power-to-weight ratio, and it employed a wheel-come-track system.
This meant it could travel either on its tracks or on its road wheels, with power supplied from a drive chain from the sprocket wheel.
However, for a variety of reasons, not least his somewhat difficult personality, I don't know what it is with engineers, the US Army were not interested in the technology. But the Soviets were, and they were very keen to get their hands on it. And using a little espionage and deception, they were able to purchase two of Christie's tanks, minus their turrets, and had them shipped to the USSR, labelled tractor parts. And a few years later, Christie's designs could be found adding a little bounce to some of the world's first mass-produced fast tanks, the Soviet BT series.
These were really fast.
The BT-7 version weighed a little over 15 tonnes, mounted a 45mm gun, and was capable of up to 53 miles per hour on the road and 31 miles an hour cross country. Emphasising this, there is lots of Soviet propaganda film of the BT-7 in flight, right off the ground, jumping obstacles. Very exciting. But what was the purpose? Before the Germans unleashed Blitzkrieg, the Soviets were dabbling with a similar concept themselves. They called it deep battle, fast-paced, probing and encirclement operations for an age where cavalry were obsolete. In combat against the Japanese at Khalkhin Gol in 1939, the BT-5 and BT-7s proved too fast for the Japanese anti-tank gunners, suggesting that speed really could be just as effective as armour.
But by 1941, time had caught up with them. The gun was too weak and the armour far too thin to compete against contemporary German armour. They may have become obsolete, but from the BT-7 evolved this, the T-34.
T-34 retained the Christie suspension and added the excellent Kharkov V2 diesel engine, as well as a range of other features, such as sloped armour and increased firepower, making it one of the most effective tanks ever. The T-34 had a top speed of 33 miles per hour and excellent cross-country mobility. So, for this video at least, it's sort of a fast tank.
And it proved it in 1942. Having resisted the German summer offensive, it played a key role in the double encirclement maneuver which trapped the German 6th Army in Stalingrad. Whilst the T-34 isn't a perfect example of speed as a replacement for armour, it did demonstrate the importance of speed and mobility on an open modern battlefield. And that is something that designers of future main battle tanks would not be able to ignore.
Mechanisation of the 1930s saw traditional horsed cavalry units converting to tanks and armoured cars. But in the British Army, there was still something of a culture war going on between those who backed the tank and mechanisation and those who still thought that cavalry could do a better job of exploitation in the right circumstances.
Emerging British doctrine allowed for something of an honourable compromise. And as cavalry regiments mechanised, sometimes somewhat reluctantly, they were given vehicles, initially armoured cars like this Lanchester, that enabled them to carry on tearing about doing cavalry-type things. They also got the newer, faster cruiser tanks.
According to a new British doctrine developed by Martel, Montgomery Massingbird and Ellis, there would be two classes of tank.
Infantry tanks, like this Matilda, would support infantry as they assaulted enemy positions. So they needed good armour, but they didn't need to be fast. Cruiser tanks would exploit the breaches made to attack the enemy's rear, fulfilling the role of the cavalry. Now that just about kept the cavalry interests happy, but it did result in some of the worst tanks ever built. British military observers saw the Christie suspension demonstrated the Kiev manoeuvres in 1936 and realised it would be absolutely ideal for their new cruiser tanks. It was first fitted to this. This is the A-13 cruiser, which appeared in 1940. But before that, the A-9 and A-10 cruisers had been produced from 1938. They would all see combat in France in 1940.
Speed was to be prioritised over everything. But the problem was that the technology, and particularly engines at this point, weren't really up to it.
The A-13 cruiser had Christie suspension, and it used the more powerful Nuffield Liberty V12 engine, 340 horsepower. That gave it a top speed of 40 miles an hour, with a maximum 30 millimetres of armour protection.
The first big test for the British cruiser tanks came in the spring of 1940, as the German army stormed into France and Belgium.
It was a test that they ultimately failed. During the Battle of Abbeville on May 27th and 28th, amidst the chaos, confusion and a massive breakdown of communications, the British 1st Armoured Division lost 69 tanks, many to mechanical failure, but most from anti-tank guns, which would suggest that maybe speed wasn't much in the way of armour.
War in the desert would suit the cruisers better, and here they'd get a fresh opportunity to prove themselves.
British tank designers were working on two new cruisers, the A-13 Mark III Covenanter and the A-15 Crusader. One made it into service, and the other has been rubbished as one of the worst tanks ever built.
Designed in parallel, both had a far lower profile than the early cruisers, had Christie suspension, and initially at least, both mounted a two-pounder gun. History, however, has been a lot less kind to this one, the Covenanter.
In trials in 1940, the prototype managed an impressive 37 miles an hour, and limited trials in North Africa showed that, with a lot of cosseting, it could be reliable, even in desert conditions. But it was a complicated design, and ultimately the Crusader was preferred, and the Covenanter was relegated to a training role. In North Africa, the Crusader would become a stalwart of the desert war, showing that, in the right circumstances, the cruiser concept could work. Powered by the Nuffield Liberty V12 engine, giving 340 horsepower, it was capable of 26 miles an hour on the road and 15 miles an hour off. Armour thickness ranged from a maximum 40 to 50 millimetres.
The Crusader was faster than the Axis tanks it came across, and it was also better at firing on the move. But these advantages disappeared when the Africa Corps changed tactics and feigned retreat to lure Allied tanks onto dug-in anti-tank gun screens.
Crusader proved useful in the pursuit of the Afrika Korps after Alamein, but ultimately the tank's biggest weakness was its build quality. Attrition and a shortage of spare parts saw the significance of the Crusader begin to fade,
particularly with the arrival of US medium tanks. But the British Army still hadn't lost the desire to field a cruiser, and what followed was a big improvement.
For Cromwell, a new cruiser tank was ready in time for the Normandy invasion. It used Christie suspension like the earlier cruisers, but it used a brand new engine, the excellent Rolls-Royce Meteor engine.
This 600 horsepower 12-cylinder petrol engine was a version of the Merlin Aero engine, downrated by the removal of the supercharger and with its run reversed to suit tank transmission. In trials, the prototype made runs of over 50 miles per hour, but the suspension couldn't cope. So in the end, it was governed at 40 miles per hour, still very quick for the time.
The Cromwell had reasonable armour, 64 millimetres on the front glacis and 76 millimetres up at the front of the turret. And all in all, it weighed in at 28 tonnes, slightly more than a Sherman. Crew opinions on the Cromwell were pretty mixed. A Sergeant Bramwell of the 8th Hussars said it was an atrocious tank, was fast enough, but thin-skinned and undergunned.
He may have had a point. In the confused and brutal fighting in the Normandy Bocage, the Cromwell wasn't at its best.
What we see again and again is that the cruiser concept, speed as armour, does not work if the battlefield doesn't allow them to use that speed and manoeuvrability.
This was demonstrated on the 13th of June 1944, when Hauptsturmführer Michael Wittmann's SS Tiger Company accounted for 20 Cromwells at Vera Bocage. Against Tiger tanks and hemmed in by buildings, they were more or less helpless.
things would get better and the Cromwell would come into its own during the period that the British refer to as the Great Swan.
In the late summer of 1944, German resistance in northwest Europe collapsed under a British and Canadian onslaught that pushed from Normandy into Belgium at terrific pace.
The 175-mile Great Swan, where Cromwell's worked well in the armoured reconnaissance role, is probably the high watermark for the speed as armour concept in World War II. It was a remarkably agile tank. In a famous instance in Holland, a troop of three Cromwells, surprised by a bigger enemy force, jumped a 20-foot-wide canal to retreat.
The German army never really embraced the speed-as-armour concept. I mean, the Panzer IIs and IIIs of the Blitzkrieg era were quite quick, but the Panzer II would soon be obsolete, and the Panzer III was up-armoured to the extent that it lost a lot of its original speed.
This became a theme with later German tanks like the Panther and Tiger, focusing on heavier armour and more powerful guns.
With a couple of exceptions, like this, the Panzer II Luchs reconnaissance vehicle, and the Panzer 38T Hetzer, and that's a tank destroyer, it's actually built to be fast, the weight of armour was generally increasing on the battlefield. And that is probably best demonstrated by the arrival in 1944 of this, the King Tiger.
But the Brits weren't the only ones dabbling in lighter, faster armour. Although it had rejected Walter Christie's earlier designs, the US Army realised it needed something faster and more mobile with the war approaching. The M3 Stuart, weighing just over 13 tonnes, had an impressive top speed of 36 miles an hour on the road, and for a light tank of the time, it was pretty well armoured with 44 millimetres of frontal armour on the hull. As a light tank, it was designed to fulfil typical cavalry roles, such as screening and reconnaissance. But early in the war, it was capable of much more, often going toe-to-toe with enemy tanks.
Compared to the British Crusader, the M3 was much, much more reliable. It was several tonnes lighter, had a top speed 10 miles per hour faster, and had broadly similar armour and firepower. As the war went on, the M3 and its successor, the M5, would be restricted to its intended reconnaissance role, finding itself increasingly vulnerable in head-on confrontations. It was set to be replaced by a tank that has much more in common with the Cromwell.
The M24 Chaffee. Now, the thing the crews liked best about this tank was the 75mm M6 gun. That's basically the same gun as you find on the Cromwell. That is a lot of hitting power for a light tank. But they also found it had weaknesses in common with the Cromwell.
Whilst the speed and mobility was appreciated, it wasn't a good compromise for better protection when fighting a defensively minded enemy with Panzerfausts and powerful anti-tank guns.
But the fastest tracked AFV of World War II, with a top speed of 55 miles an hour, was the M18 Hellcat. While actually tank destroyers, these vehicles, and that includes this British Achilles behind me, were designed to use superior speed and mobility to break up Blitzkrieg-style armoured thrusts. Unfortunately, in practical terms, what that meant was sacrificing almost all their armour for superior firepower and mobility.
While frequently giving a good account of themselves, the thin armour, which is just over half an inch over most of the vehicle, and open-topped turret made them extremely vulnerable.
The evidence was starting to suggest that it might be better to have tanks that were good all-rounders rather than vehicles that were suited to a particular role. The British Army went on to field another cruiser tank, this one, the Comet. Better armour and the 77mm high-velocity gun, so good hitting power. But tank development was moving on. And as the war comes to a close, the first of what we call the universal tanks, the Centurion, makes an appearance.
This is the Tank Museum's cut-in-half example.
It was intended to be the British Army's next cruiser tank. Centurion would then be replaced by the A45, the universal tank.
The Centurion was powered by the brilliant Rolls-Royce 4B Meteor engine, giving it 650 horsepower and a top speed of around 21 miles per hour. And it also had between 51 and 152 millimetres of armour. All in all, it weighed about 50 tonnes.
So, it wasn't fast, but it was fast enough. Its cross-country mobility and armour protection being neatly balanced for the reality of the contemporary battlefield. This turned out to be a good thing, as the A45 was cancelled and the Centurion had to step into the role of the universal tank.
But the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the Centurion went on to be one of the most successful tanks ever built. It took a while, but finally, the British Army, after a pretty patchy performance in World War II, got over their speed as armour concept and realised sacrificing a bit of speed for better armour made sense. Pretty much what the German Army had thought all along.
Leaping ahead, main battle tanks, the inheritors of the universal tank concept, became the mainstay of Cold War armies on both sides. But opinions on how to build a main battle tank varied. This one, British Chieftain, that's a 60-ton heavyweight slugger. Whereas the West German Leopard 1 we have here, that's probably the best embodiment of the speed as armour concept.
The first tank built for the post-World War II Bundeswehr, the view was taken that tank rounds, particularly heat, were now so destructive that no amount of armour would provide protection. Armour thickness ranges from 10 to 70 millimetres. The weight is 40 tonnes, and the top speed is 40 miles an hour. It's almost 20 tonnes lighter than the Chieftain, and 15 miles an hour faster.
Having steered clear of the speed as armour concept all the way through the war, the West Germans now bought into it.
So far, we've seen a variety of thinking behind speed as armour, from the pre-war BT range to the Leopard 1. But is this still a current tank design concept, leaving recce vehicles and armoured cars out of the equation?
We'd have to say no, because technology has increased to such a pitch that these days, you can have it all.
If you take the M1 Abrams, the tank is superbly well protected, has a hard-hitting smoothbore 120mm gun and weighs 67 tonnes. But with its 1,500 horsepower Honeywell gas turbine engine, it will still hit 45 miles an hour, and that's governed, on the road, and 25 miles an hour across country.
This British Challenger 2 and the German Leopard 2 are pretty well comparable. They are fast, well protected with composite armour, and they've got a highly effective gun.
So, does speed as armour work? We'd have to say, on balance, probably not.
There are a fair few types of vehicle that we haven't really talked about here. Recce vehicles, like the 8-tonne, 60 miles an hour CVRT range, for instance, where speed is vital.
But when it comes to plain, ordinary gun tanks, compromising on armour is extremely risky.
Mobility is always a good thing, of course, but sacrificing armour protection for speed only works in the right circumstances. Khalkhin Gol, against the Italians in the Western Desert, and during the Great Swap.
But against a determined and effective enemy, and under the wrong conditions, as was the case in France 1940 and Normandy 1944, you are more likely to come off worse.
What do you think about speed as armour? Does it work? Let us know in the comments below.